another episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. We're back with you as we head towards the end of the A-10 season. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by Matt. And things are getting kind of crazy. We're just a day off of Dayton's wild 22-point comeback against VCU, in which they took the lead but managed to not hold on at the end.
Yeah, one of the most exciting second halves of the season in the A-10. VCU up 12 points at halftime, went on a quick 10-0 run, which forced Dayton to call a timeout. And right after that, the Flyers really started picking it up, just chipping away at the lead. Their defense really started playing well. VCU wasn't getting any open shots. And unfortunately for Dayton, VCU hung in there once they gave up the lead, and then a Marcus Evans layup with about 6 seconds to go ended up winning the Rams the game.
Yeah, and once again, Dayton has shown that they are a supremely talented team who, when they're playing the right way for their players, is really unstoppable. We've now seen in the last 5 games, if you take out the Rhode Island game in which everyone was just awesome and they ran them over, Dayton has played much better in the second half than in the first half. And so you got to give credit to the coaching staff for the adjustments that they've made at halftime of each of these games, or in the case of yesterday, the adjustments that they made after the first time out, given that they had a really ugly first 2 minutes of the second half. But it does just make you wonder when they might just go to what has worked in the second half instead of starting all of these games the way they always do.
Yeah, it was an encouraging second half for sure. And as a Dayton fan, I was really pleased that they didn't give up, they didn't cave in when they were faced with a huge deficit, but it is frustrating to know that if they played a better first half, or if they started off the second half better, it would have been a win. The second half does show, I think, that Dayton, they can beat anybody in this conference when they're playing at their best, but they haven't had a ton of games in the A-10 where they have a full 40 minutes, and if they want to make a tournament or a championship run in the A-10 tournament, they need to play a complete game against good teams like VCU.
It's weird. They've kind of turned into Duquesne, where from the standpoint of both of these teams just look horrendous in the first 10 minutes, just about every game they play, except for some weird reason when Duquesne plays George Washington, they catch fire to start the game. But the difference there is Duquesne tends to come out in the second half. Their guys look more lively, they've changed up their offense a little bit, and they're just making more shots. Whereas Dayton, it's more so on the other end, where they have to switch up their defense to really get things going. And Davidson on Tuesday is going to be a really interesting game. The evidence is starting to mount that when Dayton just locks up and just plays great man-to-man, as they did in the second half against St. Joe's, Duquesne, St. Louis, VCU, their defense has actually been really good. And we saw that yesterday, they only gave up 17 points in the last 18 minutes. Well, Davidson is the kind of team that will absolutely destroy you if their shooters get open. And so it'll be interesting to see if Dayton continues to play their kind of semi-aggressive pseudo-trapping system that they like, at the risk that a guy like Keyshawn Pritchard or Luke Frampton could burn them early on.
Yeah, that's going to be a huge game for Dayton against Davidson. Big chance for them to redeem themselves and stay in the top four of the standings, but big concern for them is that Trey Landers missed the VCU game with a shoulder injury. Not a whole lot of details out there on that, but his availability Tuesday is in doubt right now. He's their leading rebounder, and that was a big issue against VCU. Dayton gave up 14 offensive rebounds, and if Landers was in there, they just would have had a better time boxing out. Especially in the first half, Obi Toppin got himself into foul trouble, and that was really when Dayton's rebounding started to fall apart. So, at this point, we don't know if Landers will be there or not Tuesday against Davidson, or even at any point this season. There's not much information out there. But he will be a big piece moving forward, even though he's not a big scorer for Dayton. His rebounding is huge for a team that hasn't done a great job on the glass in conference play.
And let's throw some heavy praise on VCU, because yeah, they blew a giant lead, but you can't blow a huge lead if you don't have one in the first place. And I don't know, yesterday really doesn't change my opinion on this team much, What continues to hold me back over and over again is when things get bogged down, I don't know how they can score. And yesterday was kind of indicative of that. The one thing that they did have going for them is Marcus Evans essentially played himself into the Player of the Year conversation that we'll discuss later with 10 points throughout the second half. And it doesn't sound like much, but when your team puts up 17 points to close out the game, one guy having over half of those is really what kept them afloat. He had the game-winning bucket where he just burned Dwayne Cohill. Dayton didn't send the help. And Evans really was terrific. And he's going to have to do that. If they're going to win any games in the NCAA tournament, when teams start to really lock in on this offense that is so reliant on just other defenses essentially being stupid and getting guys like Deriontay Jenkins open threes or Marcos Santos Silva just bullying smaller guys, Evans is really the one thing that they have that can beat just about any defense.
Yeah, Evans was huge down the stretch for VCU. As you said, they struggled to get buckets in the most of the second half, but after the last media timeout, he really started to carry the Rams, and of course the big layup at the end of the game. And it was a tale of two halves for VCU overall, because their second half offense looked pretty familiar to their offense at the beginning of the season when they struggled to put up points against good teams. The first half was very impressive for VCU, though. They were firing on all cylinders, finding open threes. Deriontay Jenkins, especially, looked very good from beyond the arc. And if they can get that offense going, they definitely could win a game in the NCAA tournament.
My biggest question for the Rams going forward is who's their fifth guy? They keep playing an 11-deep rotation, and they got a lot of interesting players on the bench. And obviously, they got a strong big four with Evans, Jenkins, Santos Silva, and Isaac Van, who I continue to really like as their glue guy X factor. But I just don't know who their fifth guy is. Down the stretch yesterday, it was Corey Douglas on defense. It was Sean Mobley on offense. Although Mobley ended up getting shut out in that game. I kind of like Mikhail Sims. He made a few impressive plays in that game. But I just don't know who is the fifth guy that you trust on that team down the stretch.
Yeah, VCU, they have the benefit of having a deep roster where they have a lot of guys they can put in the game, but at least offensively, they don't have a ton of consistent guys that can produce for them. So moving forward, one of those bench players might need to establish themselves as someone they can trust in a close game.
And now looking ahead for VCU, things are starting to look very bright. They're quietly on a 6-game win streak that includes 3 tough road wins at Dayton, at St. Bonaventure, probably the 2 toughest places to play in the A-10 outside of their own arena. And then an at Duquesne game, which I don't know how much stock you want to put in that win, given that the Dukes didn't have Sincere Carey that night. But it was right around the time that the attendance was starting to tick up for Duquesne. The Dukes have been playing really well. And so VCU has gone on the road and gotten 3 really tough road wins in these last few games. And now they're going to be home for the next 3. The schedule's not that particularly hard. They actually don't leave the state of Virginia again until the A-10 tournament. And if they can go 5-1, that gets them to that magic number of 15-3. And I just don't see how they miss the tournament if they can win 5 of their last 6, barring just an absolutely disastrous loss in Brooklyn.
Yeah, at this point, VCU, they seem to be setting themselves up for a potential at-large bid. And while we're on that topic, talking about, they do have a pretty easy rest of the season. We wanted to go into who we thought had the best chances of getting into the top 4, getting that double bye in the A-10 tournament. So, first of all, I just want to say Davidson and VCU both sitting at 10-2. Both have 2 of the easier schedules remaining this season. I would say at this point, they're pretty much locked into the top 4. I don't know if they'll get in the top 2. That's probably the most likely scenario, where they finish 1-2 in either order. But after that, there's about 5 teams that are still in contention for the final 2 spots in Brooklyn.
Yeah, and you say with VCU and Davidson being locked in, Not only do they have that cushion at the top, but VCU's tied for the second easiest remaining schedule. Davidson, who actually had the easiest remaining schedule for most of the year, that has dropped to fourth, but still, two of the easier stretches left in the A-10 for those two teams. And, like I said, I'm starting to feel very confident that VCU is going to make the tournament. I've said that 15-3 is that magic number. That's starting to look like it won't hold true for Davidson, just given how horrendous both of their losses were. But I will say, if the Wildcats can run the table and get to 16-2, I don't think that we can completely eliminate them from the at-large discussion.
No, I don't think we can eliminate them, because this gets said every... I think this gets thrown around every year, but the bubble isn't that great this year. I don't think it's ever been great since they expanded the field to 68, but if they did go 16-2, that would be a lot of wins for a mid-major to leave them out. My problem with Davidson is their best win of the season would probably be at home versus VCU. Their only other quadrant two wins are at George Mason, St. Louis, and St. Bonaventure. And I just don't think that's good enough considering some of their losses. Right now, I would say they have three bad losses. UMass and St. Joe's in the A-10, and then at Wake Forest. I know they didn't have Grady for that one, but Wake Forest is terrible. So, you know, crazier things have happened. Sometimes the selection committee surprises everyone. If Davidson ran the table and then lost in the final of the A-10 tournament, so that would mean that they would go 8-1 the rest of the way, they would have a slim chance, I think, depending on bid sealers and other small conferences or just other bubble teams in general. But at this point, I think Davidson probably needs to win the A-10 tournament.
Yeah, and unfortunately for them, it's impossible for them to add a win over VCU to their at-large resume, given that if they would meet even as early as the semifinals in the A-10 tournament, that would mean that one of the two really cooled off from here on out. So either Davidson would have already knocked themselves out of contention, or a win against VCU wouldn't mean as much because the Rams would have fallen apart. So right now it's looking most likely that those two wouldn't play again till the final. And then obviously if you win that game, if you're Davidson, your at-large resume doesn't matter because you'd be going dancing anyway.
So Davidson and VCU, both 10-2, they're probably going to finish in the top two in the conference. After that, it gets a lot closer. So the current teams in position for the double bye, George Mason at 9-4, they just lost to the Bonnies. Pretty bad game for them overall. And then Dayton at 8-4. At this point, I think those two teams will probably finish the season in those positions. I'm not sure which one will be ahead, but if I had to pick today, I think they're probably both going to be in the top four. Not only are they ahead, but I also just think they're the third and fourth best teams in the conference at this point.
So they're sitting right now, Dayton a half game up on Duquesne and SLU, and a full game up on St. Bonaventure. We're going to mention this right now for both double byes and the race to avoid Wednesday. LaSalle is sitting in the middle at 6-6, and so they are two games back in the loss column of a double bye, while also being two wins up on a spot in Wednesday. And it kind of just feels like the Explorers are just floating in this middle territory. We'll almost certainly see their first game on Thursday. And while a big run in either direction could certainly change that for LaSalle, it feels like they're just going to settle in somewhere to like the 7-8-9 conversation. So we're not really going to cover the Explorers much in either of these discussions.
Yeah, I would say for LaSalle, they probably either have to win out to maybe get in the top four or lose out to get in the bottom four. So I don't think either of those are going to happen given how their season's been at 500 in the A-10. But anyways, first we'll move on to Duquesne. They're 8-5, only half a game out from a spot in the top four. But they still have a few tough games coming up. The rest of the season, they're at St. Bonaventure, at St. Louis, and then they finish their season at home against Dayton. But the key game on everyone's mind right now, their next game, a week from now, at George Mason. And if Duquesne wins that game, they would be tied in the standings with George Mason, But that would also give them the tiebreaker over Mason. So I really think that's the key game for them. If they can win that, the tiebreaker over Mason would be huge. And it would also just be a good win over a solid team. I think if they want to realistically get in the top four, they have to win that game.
So looking ahead, we got plenty of these head-to-head battles left. If you take the five teams still scrapping for this double bye, there's actually seven head-to-heads left. Now, in the remaining six half weeks of the season, we have nothing coming up during the weekdays of this week, largely because both Duquesne, SLU, and George Mason all have their bye. But then this Saturday, the 23rd, St. Louis is at Dayton for the Arch Barron Cup rematch. Duquesne's at George Mason. Next Wednesday, the 27th, Duquesne's at Bonaventure. Saturday the 2nd, George Mason's at SLU. Wednesday the 6th, Duquesne is at SLU. And then to wrap up the regular season on Saturday the 9th, SLU is at the Bonnies. And in the last game of the A-10 season, Dayton is at Duquesne. So SLU really is the team that controls their own destiny here. Four of their last five remaining games are against the teams that they're competing with. Unfortunately for them, the fifth game is against VCU. And so they currently sit at dead last in remaining strength of schedule for the conference. The average game left for them is a team with a 68% winning percentage in conference. The next toughest is Duquesne at 55. And so things are going to get really tough for the Billikens down the stretch. They had to beat LaSalle last night, though, and they looked pretty impressive doing that.
Yeah, that was definitely a good win for SLU. If you look at the standings and see them half a game out, then you would think that they're right in the thick of things and they have a good chance in the top four, but I look at their schedule, they still go at Dayton, VCU, and St. Bonaventure. I mean, in my eyes, those are the three toughest places to win. And realistically, I don't think there's any way they win all three of them. I think they should be happy with one win. And then their home games, they still have to play Duquesne and Mason. So, brutal rest of the season for them. And like you said, they do control their own destiny. So if they got hot, this would be the best time of the season for it, because they would also be knocking down teams ahead of them as they win. But I don't know. It just seems a lot of times when St. Louis plays a good team, they fight the whole game and then just come up a little bit short. So if they can turn that around in these last couple of weeks, then they would earn their spot in the top four, but I don't see that happening.
Yeah, and you can say all you want about how tough the schedule is. In the end, SLU is probably one of the four or five most talented teams in the A-10. They just haven't shown it at all. I agree with you. I just don't see the scenario where they survive this brutal schedule. And honestly, they've just been so inconsistent all season. I don't really know what would have to happen for them to get through this. For me, I'm looking at I think Dayton's actually pretty safe, despite the fact that they continue to kind of shoot themselves in their foot with some of their losses. Like the Mason game is still one that I think everyone on that team would want back. But they continue to prove that they're supremely talented. The schedule's not that tough, whereas Duquesne, SLU, and then Mason actually has the 11th easiest schedule, so they're not in a great spot either. I think those are the teams that are going to scrap it out. Saturday's Duquesne-Mason game is going to tell us a lot as to who is the favorite for that four spot. The schedule's going to get too hard for SLU, and as much as I like the Bonnies, they're in a slight hole right now. I just don't see them doing it, although they are a dark horse that I like for that. I think it's going to be Dayton and whoever wins the Mason-Duquesne game getting the two double byes.
Yeah, that's probably the safest pick, and I pretty much agree with that. I think Mason, at this point, I just think they're a better team than Duquesne, although it is close. And if Duquesne can pull off that win in Fairfax, that would be huge for them, and that could lead them to a double bye. I'm just not sure if I see that happening, because George Mason, in conference play, they've done a good job at home. But before we move on, we do need to talk about the Bonnies, even though they're only 7-5, so they're only one game back. They're a little bit of a dark horse, though, at this point, since they have a lot of teams to pass in the standings. They have one really tough game left at Davidson, who they already lost to at home in a pretty good game a few weeks ago. After that, their schedule, or other than that, I should say, their schedule isn't that bad. And their game today against George Mason, they had some stellar performances from guys like Kyle Lofton, Oshunyi, and Courtney Stockard. If those guys can keep playing at that level, you never know. The Bonnies could get really hot all of a sudden and make a move toward the top of the standings. I don't think that there's a good chance of that happening, getting in the top four. Although, I do think the Bonnies could be a team to watch. If I had to pick one team outside the top four to potentially win the A-10 tournament, I think I'd go with the Bonnies at this point, because they seem like that team that could put together a couple really good games, given some of the stars on their team.
You know what, I don't think I gave the Bonnies the proper due. And part of the issue is that they continue to be game-by-game pretty inconsistent. But so has George Mason. Whereas Dayton and Duquesne are far more along the lines of half-by-half inconsistent. We tend to see both of those teams kind of lay an egg early on and then catch fire in the second half. And if they lose, it's because they just dug themselves too deep of a hole. Mason and Bonaventure have both just laid some absolute duds for just entire games in the last few weeks. But the Bonnies are kind of trending in a different direction than the Patriots. And while George Mason's still going to be in pretty strong control if they can beat Duquesne next week, I think if Duquesne can beat George Mason, that really opens the door for the Bonnies. And then all of a sudden, you look ahead 4 days from then. Wednesday the 27th, Duquesne going up to Olean. A rivalry game that, for so much of our lifetime, has meant absolutely nothing, could actually be very big. And the last time these two teams played, they both played probably their worst game of the season, and St. Bonaventure happened to just play slightly less bad.
Yeah, that was not a very fun game to watch, but as you said, the Bonnies, super inconsistent game to game. That VCU game, when they went down by 30 points at home, that's got to be one of their worst home losses ever, just given how they usually play there. But if you take that out of the equation, they've actually, for the most part, done a very good job in conference play. Even some of their losses, they took Dayton to double overtime. Davidson, they lost by 9 points, but if you watch that game, it felt a lot closer than that, and then Davidson pulled away at the end. But other than that, they've just destroyed St. Joe's twice, including once at Hawk Hill. Obviously, today's big win against George Mason. And then that Duquesne game, even though it wasn't pretty, to be able to grind out a game like that, that takes some guts, I think. And at the end of the day, it doesn't have to look good to count as a win, and that could be something huge for them. If they could knock off Duquesne again and take the tiebreaker over them, it could potentially help them out in terms of seeding.
Yeah, and they're right dead middle. Their schedule's right around 500 the rest of the way. So the opportunity's there. Now, we won't talk about this nearly as long as we just did the bye conversation, but the battle for Wednesday is starting to get really intense. Of course, the bottom four teams forced to show up early to Brooklyn and play Wednesday games. I actually believe they're in the early afternoon this year, so we're really going beyond mid-major with this one. At the moment, it would be St. Joe's at 4-9 playing against 2-10 UMass, and 3-9 GW playing against 2-10 Fordham. Now the team's hovering right above Richmond at 4-8, and Rhode Island at 5-7. In a span of just about a week and a half, they've knocked themselves from being right in the thick of the double bye hunt to now just trying to make sure they make it to Thursday.
So first things first, UMass and Fordham at 2-10. Are we in agreement that we can lock them into Wednesday in Brooklyn? Because I don't see them picking up enough wins to move out of the bottom four.
There's no way Fordham's going to jump out of there. I have a slight hesitation with UMass just because they've had so many games where they actually look great this year. Like, look at Providence or Davidson. And they have the second easiest schedule left. But, yeah, I mean, there's no consistency with this team. And they're going to have to win at least three more to make it there.
Yeah, I just We've said it all season that it seems like they have the talent, but they haven't really put it together. So also GW, they're 3-9, so a game up on the bottom two. Interestingly, they're by far the worst team on KenPom, and I'm not sure how important that is once you get past about 200, and they're in the 270s right now, I believe. I see them staying in the bottom four at this point just because they haven't done a whole lot to impress me this season. The interesting pair of teams I look at, we have Richmond at 4-8 and St. Joe's at 4-9. St. Joe's has the tiebreaker over them. They beat them a few weeks ago. But the Hawks only have 2 home games left in their last 5, while Richmond has 3. Richmond has a few tough games, though. They still have to play VCU and Davidson. At this point, I probably expect them to tie in the standings or be close to that. So I give a slight edge to St. Joe's avoiding playing in the first round just because they have the tiebreaker, but I think that's mostly what you need to pay attention to at this point, those two teams, in terms of who's going to avoid the first round in the A-10.
Yeah, I have zero faith in GW to make it out. I actually would be more confident in UMass. I think this is a battle for one spot. The Colonials have actually lost 4 straight. They've lost 7 of their last 8. The only win was at home when they blew out Fordham. Weirdly, they're 2-0 in the city of Philadelphia this year, winning at St. Joe's and at LaSalle. As the Explorers continue to get better, that at LaSalle win is starting to look kind of weird. But I had GW in the bottom 2 at the end of the non-conference. They got a nice team, but now we also don't know if Terry Nolan's healthy. He went down at the end of the Duquesne game. And if he's out, they might go winless the rest of the year. So for me, it's 3 teams trying to stave off one spot. Is it crazy for me to say that I am actually more confident that St. Joe's is going to make it out than Rhodey?
I don't think Rhodey's going to fall that far. They're 5-7, so they're a game and a half up on St. Joe's right now. And that was a disastrous loss for them against Fordham. At home, on their home court, they can't even prove that they're the best Rams in the conference right now after that game. But I just think they have more talent than most of the teams in the bottom. They do have to go at VCU and Dayton, so I don't expect them to win either of those 2 games. But they still have a home game against GW, and they wrap up their season against UMass at home in a chance for redemption. I think there's a very strong chance they win both of those 2 games. And if they get to 7 wins, they're safe. I don't see them going 1-5 down the stretch.
So St. Joe's actually has the easiest schedule left in the conference. And when you look at the half of the tougher schedules, you have the 5 teams battling for the double byes we discussed, all in that 8-14 range. Rhode Island has the 9th easiest schedule, and then Richmond actually has the 3rd toughest schedule still left. This is really hard to predict because St. Joe's and Richmond have been just the 2 most bizarre teams in the conference this year. We keep saying on our Twitter, don't bet on games involving St. Joe's. I think that Sully from Blackburn Review, who's been doing great with his picks this year, has the same rule. I don't know what's going to happen with the Hawks, but I continue to believe that they're still good enough to avoid the bottom 4, especially now that Anthony Longprey's back. He's a guy that I've just been really impressed with all year.
Yeah, even though St. Joe's, they're half a game behind Richmond right now, I just think the schedule and the tiebreaker, when you put that together, that the Hawks have a much easier road to the end of the season, and that they have the tiebreaker over Richmond with their win over them a few weeks ago. I think St. Joe's has the better chance of either getting a 9 or 10 seed in the A-10 tournament. But at this point, I don't think any of these teams are winning the A-10 tournament. I'm not sure how big of a deal these games are, but it's worth talking about because if anything, there's a way better chance, or your chances of winning the A-10 tournament go way up when you have to play only 4 games compared to 5. At four games, you could maybe make something happen, but at five, none of these teams are 2009 UConn, or whatever year that was. Nobody's going to do that in the A-10 this year, and win five games in 5 days.
Yeah, if I had to predict right now, I would say that we're looking at an opening game of UMass against GW, followed in that doubleheader by Richmond against Fordham.
Alright, so with that, we're going to move into our final topic of this podcast. We're just going to go over a few of the candidates and maybe a couple of dark horses for Conference Player of the Year as we get into the last couple weeks of the season.
So I looked around, came up with seven names. One of the more difficult things was that both Dayton and Duquesne just, quite frankly, don't have a Player of the Year candidate. Those two teams just rely on the fact that their 1 through 6 on both squads are just so good, and a lot of those players are really even, and quite frankly, I'm not all that sure who the best player is on either of those two teams. So, of my seven, I have three guys that I'm putting an honorable mention at the moment. Charlie Brown of St. Joe's, the conference's leading scorer, 18.8 points a game during the conference season. For me, it's just a combination of the fact that if the season ended today, St. Joe's would be playing on Wednesday. I find it really hard to give Player of the Year to a guy on a team that bad when he's not just a truly transcendent guy. Also, he's just been too one-dimensional as just a scorer. He's brought his rebounding numbers up in the past few weeks, but he doesn't just give enough all around. Justin Kier of George Mason, a guy who was the hot favorite 2 or 3 weeks into the season, he's kind of cooled off. He's now back under 15 points a game, although he does have an impressive 8.5 rebounds a game in conference play. For me, even though Kier has the better stats, I'm still just not 100% sure he's even the best player on his own team. That distinction might go to Otis Livingston at this point. And then Marcus Evans, who, by all accounts of the eye test, seems like a guy who could be Player of the Year, but his counting stats just aren't there. 13.4 points a game, 3 assists a game. He's VCU's engine. As we talked about at the beginning of this pod, he's their closer. But VCU's not getting it done because of Marcus Evans' stardom. They're getting it done because they have four really good players leading their team.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on the last two guys you mentioned, Kier and Evans. I would say they are both, well, like you said, Livingston's obviously a great talent for George Mason, but I would say Kier and Evans are having the two best seasons for two of the best teams in the conference. I just don't think either of their stat lines hold up in terms of Conference Player of the Year. I would definitely say they're going to make one of the conference teams, whether it's second or third team, but at this point their stats don't quite stick out enough for me. As for Charlie Brown, I'm going to disagree a little bit. Even though I wouldn't give him the award right now, in part because St. Joe's is not who we expected them to be, he is the leading scorer in the conference. His rebounding has picked up when they had to deal with a few injuries and they relied on him a little bit more in that regard. He's also at just about 39% from three, and overall, I just think he's one of the best scorers in the conference. So although I wouldn't have him as Player of the Year if I had to pick today, I think he would probably be in my top three at this point.
So I'll take it to my number four. Cyril Langevin of Rhode Island, 14.4 points a game, 10.2 rebounds, 1.6 blocks a game for his conference stats. And those don't necessarily sound like Player of the Year numbers, but he's so important to that team defensively, as is another guy that I have in my top four. And he's had to deal with some trouble offensively, mainly the fact that as part of one of the worst three-point shooting teams in the country, teams can just collapse on Langevin. They can clog up the driving lanes for Jeff Doughton and take away the drop-off pass. So things have not been easy for Langevin on the offensive end. Just the fact that he's averaging a double-double is extremely impressive. And while Rhodey's starting to move downwards, something that could really hurt his candidacy, he's just been all around so spectacular, and I really think he's been the most impressive big man in the conference this year.
Yeah, definitely agree on Langevin. I don't have him as my conference player of the year either, but I would say he's either second or third along with Charlie Brown. They're close for me. The fact that he's the only player in the conference to average a double-double, very impressive. I didn't really see this coming. I thought he would have a solid year, but I expected Jeff Dowden to be Rhodey's best player, at least statistically. And Langevin stepped up on a team that really doesn't have a whole lot of experience. And it's a good thing they bring him back next year, because his defense, averaging over a block and a half per game, he's just been a big part of their team. And even as Rhodey, they've kind of struggled the last few weeks. Obviously, they just lost to Fordham, and they were dominated by Dayton, both at home. But he's remained consistent. He put up double-doubles in each of those games, and he's someone they've come to rely on as the season has progressed.
All right, so my number three, I have another guy whose defense is critical to his team's success, Javon Bess of St. Louis. 15.9 points a game, 6.5 rebounds per game in conference play. And he's the head of what might be the nastiest, if not, maybe the second nastiest behind VCU, defensive attack in the A-10, pairing with Goodwin and French. Javon Bess has really been the one reliable scorer that SLU has been able to turn to amidst a run of games in which their offense just does not get going. I think a lot of people would actually argue that he should be player of the year right now. But for me, there's just guys who are just simply more spectacular for him offensively. And more importantly, guys who are just more critical to their team. Bess is clearly SLU's best guy. But even on the defensive end, having Jordan Goodwin next to him is really a big help. He's been great all around, but I think he's got a good backcourt around him, and that's part of what's helping him.
Yeah, Bess is someone I kind of overlooked him when coming up with this list, and I think that's mostly because St. Louis doesn't have much of an offense, so I just, in terms of big-time production, I didn't think of anybody on their team, but he's having a very solid season, one of the best defensive players in the conference, so I would expect him to be a strong candidate for all-conference defensive team. And something else to note is that his three-point shooting really took a big step forward this year. On a team that can't shoot the ball well, he is far and away their best three-point shooter and free-throw shooter, especially in terms of free throws. We know St. Louis is about as bad as it gets, so it's nice that they do have one player they can rely on at the end of the game.
So, my number two, over on Davidson, this may surprise people who haven't watched much of the Wildcats who think that Kellen Grady's their best player. He's not. It's John Axel Goodmanson. I got him second right now. Surprisingly low 15 points a game in conference, but also 7.5 rebounds, 4.3 assists per game. It's really funny. He's been great these last few games, but he's still shooting 29% from three in conference play, a number that's absolutely going to go up as we head into these final half dozen games. And if Davidson takes the regular season title and he gets his shooting numbers back to normal, he probably will win player of the year, especially given that the guy I have at number one right now, I think, might have some controversy to it. But John Axel's really just been spectacular the last few weeks. And you look at a lot of Davidson's losses, they've been in games where he just doesn't show up. And it's fun to talk about Luke Frampton. It's fun to talk about Grady. They're really fun players. But John Axel's the key piece for them.
Yeah, John Axel, we both talked about him, or we hyped him up a lot before the season. And he's delivered. I have him as my player of the year right now, if I had to pick. He just does so much for them. A really solid all-around player. Leading the A-10 in triple nickels with, I believe, 6 in conference play. And something that I think could help out Davidson a lot in the A-10 tournament, and potentially the NCAA tournament if they make it that far, is that he has the potential to absolutely take over a game. The Wichita State and St. Louis games, both down to the wire, those games come to mind for me. Both games, the Wildcats struggled to score, and they always looked to him to make the tough shots, especially against St. Louis in a hostile road environment. on a day where Kelvin Grady wasn't able to score much. John Axel just took control of that game and willed his team to victory. So, at this point, you know, we've both said it a lot this year that he may be their best player, and so far that looks to be true because he's just been very impressive all year.
So before I go to my number one, anyone else that you feel is worth mentioning?
Yeah, I have a couple other honorable mentions. I don't think any of these guys have much of a chance, but they're all good players. I do want to mention Kelvin Grady. Averaging a tiny bit more than John Axel in terms of points, but not as many rebounds or assists. And the only reason I put Grady here is that if anybody could suddenly catch fire and average like 25 to 30 points a game the rest of the season, I think it could be him. And if he did that, if he suddenly just dominated the next couple weeks, maybe he would have a chance. I also want to talk about Lawan Pipkins for UMass. At this point, I mean, he might just be a good stat, bad team guy, because we've talked about UMass, they're awful at this point, and they're not going anywhere this season, but he is the only player to average a triple nickel, and it also hurts that he has been hurt the last few games, though, so hopefully they get him back in the lineup down the stretch. And one more guy who I really regret not even including him on my all-sophomore team a couple weeks back, but Jacob Gilliard for Richmond, third in points per game, fourth in assists per game, and first in steals per game in the A-10. We gave Grant Golden a lot of attention before the season, and I believe he was on the preseason all-conference first team selected by the coaches, but I think Gilliard's actually stepped up and been the key to Richmond's success, or lack of success, but whenever they win, he's usually the one providing a lot of spark to their game. And he's been fun to watch, only a sophomore, so if he can continue to develop, that might help out Richmond down the road.
So I do want to note, this is just what I would do if I was voting right now. I think this year, with how wide open it is, there is about another half dozen or so guys, led by Grady and Pookie Pal in my mind, that if they really have a great final 3 weeks, could absolutely be in this discussion. Those two come to mind. A few of the Dayton guys, I mean, if Obi Toppin keeps rolling off like 25-point games, it's not completely crazy. Otis Livingston, there's a whole bunch of guys who could get themselves into the discussion. But for me right now, my player of the year would be Courtney Stockard from St. Bonaventure. 16.2 points a game, 7.5 rebounds, 3.5 assists a game in conference play. The Bonnies have been inconsistent, as we mentioned earlier, but he's the guy for them. And everyone wants to talk about their freshman, Kyle Lofton, Asun Ashuni. They've been really fun. But St. Bonaventure is not even close to the double bye without Stockard. We saw how bad this team can be when he was hurt to start the season. And he's just had so many great moments, whether it was his 30-plus point game against Dayton in a game that they actually ended up losing in double overtime. I just think he's been the most impressive guy for me. We had some really low expectations for the Bonnies coming into the conference season, and now all of a sudden they're right in the middle of the hunt for a top four spot. He's the reason why.
Yeah, I definitely agree. He's one of the most important players to his own team. I can't get past the fact that he missed a bunch of games at the beginning of the season, and I know none of those were in A-10 play, and I guess you could use that as an argument in favor of him since the Bonnies were just terrible with him out of the lineup, but either way, I still think he is a first-team player. Whether he wins the conference player of the year or not, he's still definitely in the discussion, and I think some of these recent Bonnie games where they've had good showings against some of the better teams in the conference, that shows his ability and how important he is to their roster.
Yeah, and for me, when I'm looking at awards, I'm almost entirely locked in on what these guys have done in conference play. And part of that is a lot of the stats of these top players really are kind of the same across the conference season as they are for the overall season. But I'm concerned 90% about what happens in January and February.
Yeah, conference season is definitely where most of the weight should go. But I do think that also helps out my case for John Axel just a little bit, because Davidson is in first place right now, and it's definitely not all about giving it to someone on a good team, but the truth is that Davidson is much more of a tournament contender than the Bonnies, and while Stockard has definitely gotten them in double by contention, even though those chances are slim, I just think when it's that close, I'm going to give it to the guy on the better team, which is why John Axel, for me right now, is my number one pick. I also have to say, this did not influence my decision at all, but he did like a few of our tweets where we shouted out some of his good performances, so we want to thank you for that, John Axel. Maybe that influenced my decision a little bit, but I don't think so. I just think he's having a great season.
So from there, we will wrap things up with some listener questions. We got one last week from a man who tends to reply to us a lot. We really appreciate it. But St. Yik Yak of Uptown asked, should I become a fan of a team that's less stressful, or am I in too deep already? Well, Mr. Yik Yak, seems like you're a Duquesne fan, just given your bio and everything. I mean, I don't really see how being a Duquesne fan is that overly stressful. As someone who grew up rooting for the Dukes, I'm pretty happy right now. And granted, some other Dukes fans in my life have had some higher expectations than I do. Very close family member telling me earlier this week that they thought that the Duquesne season might be a disappointment just because of how badly they play in the first half all the time. But this team hasn't made the tournament in 42 years. Quite frankly, the fact that they're probably going to finish above 500 in the A-10 makes this a pretty fun season. So I would say stick with it. We're at a point now that the expectations for a good Duquesne season are so low that once they actually do make the NCAA tournament again, or when they make another run to the A-10 finals, it's just going to be awesome. Duquesne right now could make it to the A-10 semis and then lose by 35, and it would still be a pretty nice way to end March. So I'd keep it there.
Yeah, at this point, Duquesne, I don't want to say they're playing with house money, because they're not. They still have a lot to play for, but right now, I just can't imagine so many big comebacks all in one year, and it seems like when you just have a couple big comebacks like that in close games, it just seems like that can tend to continue throughout the season, and that's been the case for the Dukes. But as you said, at this point, I think you have to be pleased with what they've been able to accomplish this season. They could make the postseason for the first time in a while, whether it's the NIT, CBI, whatever. And at this point, I just think you have to have fun with it, although it probably would be nice if they started either winning by a lot, or even if they just lost comfortably, because it doesn't really get your blood pressure up during those games, and it's easy to know what's going to happen early on and not have to worry about a 15-point comeback in the last 5 minutes, which they've become accustomed to doing.
So our other listener question comes from Claudette Graber. She asked, whatever happened to Mo Alley Cox? And so I think you would like to take this as your where he at for today.
All right, so Mo Alley, he's made it back into the NFL after he went undrafted in the NBA. I don't even know if he ever tried to play pro basketball. It seemed like he was always set on football. And I think that just came from the influence of every time you watched a VCU game, the announcers would talk about how he just has the fit of a tight end based on his size and athletic ability. So Mo Alley made it into the playoffs with the Indianapolis Colts, scored a couple touchdowns, including his first NFL touchdown was a one-handed grab in the corner of the end zone. So he had his moments, didn't play a whole lot because the Colts were pretty deep at tight end. But when he was out there, he had some good moments. So who knows, maybe he'll have a nice NFL career. It was definitely, as somebody that doesn't care about the NFL that much, it was fun to see him out there, just fun to have one of my favorite athletes to root for And it's just, it's so cool to see one of our own A-10 players out in the NFL doing something that he's never done before.
So we typically like to pull back some older names from where he at, but since you talked about Mo Alley, I'm going to keep it with a recent star. Dayton alum Scoochie Smith, who we saw in the crowd at Dayton and VCU yesterday. And he hasn't gone very far, still in the state of Ohio, as the starting point guard for the G League's Canton Charge. He's been to a few training camps with the Cavs now since he graduated from UD, but hasn't been able to make it into an NBA game. But he's been leading Cleveland's G League franchise, 31 starts this year in 35 games played, averaging 11.5 points, 4.2 rebounds, and a whopping 6.2 assists per game. Scoochie, with those kind of stats, might be on the precipice of the NBA pretty soon. We'll just have to watch and find out. Certainly helps that he's playing for the G League team of a squad that's pretty bad right now.
Yeah, I don't watch the NBA, but I know enough to understand how bad the Cavs are. And at this point, they need to bring up Scoochie. Give him a chance. It's not like things could get any worse for them. And I don't know. At this point, they're probably just trying to get a good draft pick anyway. So just give some experience to the young guys. We've seen Scoochie have so much success in his 4 years at Dayton. And if anybody deserves a shot at the NBA, it's him. He did so much for the Dayton Flyers. If you're an A-10 fan, you saw him. He's probably one of those guys that it seemed like he was around forever because he's one of the rare players to get a lot of minutes all 4 years of his career. But he put in a lot of time here and would love to see him make it to the NBA someday.
And so with that, we want to thank you once again for listening to the 3-Bid League podcast. Just one error today. We mentioned UConn and the legendary Kemba Walker run. Maybe we just shouldn't talk about teams outside the A-10 because that run actually happened in 2011, not 2009.
Yeah, that's my bad. I don't know what I'm talking about outside the A-10, so sorry about that.
But once again, we thank you for listening. We're getting really close to Brooklyn, so be sure to keep listening to the 3-Bid League podcast. If you don't already, please follow us on Twitter at 3BidLeaguePod. Send us any questions you want answered on there or to our email 3BidLeague@gmail.com. Those are all the number 3, not the word. And please just tell a friend if you enjoy the podcast or give us any feedback, positive or negative. We'd love to hear from you.